Hey now, the NCAA championship game was last night. Hopefully you got down. If you didn't, it is not too late to join thousands of online players and start betting at mybookie.ag. Mybookie.ag. They do it the right way. When you win, they pay. And at MyBookie, they pay quickly and they pay without any hassles. You're wasting your time betting anyplace else. Maybe you got down for the NCAA tournament and you already know. If not, it's obviously not too late to join. In fact, join right now and MyBookie will match your first deposit with a 50% bonus. Use promo code ROME in order to activate that offer. Visit MyBookie.ag today. Once again, MyBookie.ag today. Act now and MyBookie will match your first deposit with a 50% bonus. But you've got to use the promo code ROME in order to activate that offer. Again, visit MyBookie.ag today. Play, win, and get paid with MyBookie.ag.
Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Now, you know if I'm starting the program by talking about the city greasing their poles in Philadelphia. You know, it's been another great night in Philadelphia. And it's a good thing that the Crisco came out because last night was an amazing night in Philly. Villanova 79, Michigan 62. That is Nova's second title in 3 years, third overall. And last night could not have been any different than the first two. I mean, there was no perfect David v. Goliath upset. There was no last second shot. And even last night was not like Saturday's evisceration of Kansas where they hit almost everything, because at the start last night, they weren't hitting much of anything at all. Michigan's defense was causing them big problems. And then Nova found its hero. And that hero was not Jalen Brunson. It was not Omari Spellman. It was not Eric Paschal. It was not Mikhail Bridges. It was Dante DiVincenzo. Dante freaking DiVincenzo. The Michael Jordan of Delaware. I mean, how good is Villanova? Brunson, the National Player of the Year, had an off night, and they still win that game by 17. How good is Villanova? Dante, the most outstanding player of the Final Four, doesn't even start. This guy comes off the bench. But just because he comes off the bench does not mean he's doing it just to give the Stars a breather. This guy comes off the bench like a star. 31, 5, 3, 2 blocks. He kept Nova in it when everybody else was struggling with 18 points in the first half. In fact, there were stretches where it seemed like there were two or three Dantes on the floor because this dude was everywhere, scoring, ripping down rebounds, nailing chase down blocks. The MJ of Delaware was dominating like the Michael Jordan of North Carolina.
The ceiling is the roof.
The ceiling is the roof, Mike. And if you don't like the MJ of the Blue Hen State gloss, you can roll with the Big Ragu. Or you could just go with what Brunson called him after the game, a killer. That's the truth. This guy is a killer. In fact, that's a whole team of stone-cold killers. Dante, he's got so many nicknames. He's got as many nicknames as he does ways to hurt you. Remember a couple of years back, he was the Buddy Hield in game prep for their national semifinal. Last night, the guy was just straight up better than Buddy Hield. Because as nice as that 18 in the first half was, the 11 straight that he dropped at the start of the second half was even better. Just when Michigan came out at halftime and they thought they had made their adjustments, they thought they had a chance, Dante ended it and he ended them. And he did it so easily that he could have still found time to wink at his old practice rival, Josh Hart, in the stands. In fact, that's exactly what he did. Last night, this guy became the first player in a championship game to crack 30 points since Miles Simon. And if you're besting a Miles Simon title game, then you know you had yourself a good night. How good? John Beilein, one of the best coaches around and a true wizard, said this afterwards about what he did to them.
Even if we had played our best, it would have been very difficult to win that game with what DiVincenzo did. It was an incredible performance. So sometimes those individual performances just beat you, and you just say, okay, you take off your hat and say, good game. We played you the best we could, and tonight you were better than us.
Well, that's the truth, too. Last night, they were better than Michigan. In fact, all season, they were better than everybody else. And now, where does that leave Philadelphia? Now, Villanova's got two titles in 3 years. Philadelphia has two titles in 2 months. The city of brotherly love is the city of champions. Nobody can ever rap that city for not being able to win the big one. Nobody can ever rap Villanova for not being able to win in March. Philadelphia and Villanova are both golden, made. They're made now forever. And nobody will ever see those two the same way ever again. As far as Dante goes, one more thing. I mean, about the only thing this guy didn't own was Twitter. Because somebody took his one shining moment and turned it into a deep dive on his old Twitter account. And that loaded gun popped off some crazy slugs before it got shut down and Nova could release a statement saying that the account was hacked and that those tweets were not his. You know, normally I got hacked might be the most whack excuse ever. But it's not as whack as digging into some college kid's old Twitter account looking for stupid things that he may have said while he was on the court while playing the game of his life. That is whack. And while it's lesson number infinity about the dangers of social media, I'm not going to spend the day after the national championship when that guy got that nice killing a kid for tweets that he may or may not have made before he got his driver's license. I mean, listen, some of this stuff, in fact, was pretty regrettable. But who didn't say or do regrettable things when they were teenagers? The only difference is here, there's a record of it. There wasn't then, but there is now. And once again, the reminder that the internet is in ink. And there will always be somebody with nothing better to do than comb through all your old tweets if you're anybody of note just looking to burn you. You know, kind of like Dante just burned a hole through the state of Michigan. He treated the Wolverines like a speed bag. And whether he comes back to lead Nova to another tournament run or dips his toes in the NBA waters, that legendary performance is going to go down as one of the all-time greats. Me, I think I'm going to focus on that as opposed to some knucklehead tweets that he may have thumbed out when he was 14. 1-800-636-8686. What do you make of what you saw last night? Anything relating to the championship game, you want to hit me up right now. Phone lines are wide open. In addition to that, I've got thoughts on Jay Wright. Jay Wright's amazing. What he's done there is incredible. And it's hard to imagine there was also a rap that Jay Wright couldn't win in March. Jay Wright couldn't win the big one. Jay Wright might not be the right guy for that program. Has there ever been a better guy for any program than Jay Wright is with Villanova? I mean, right now, there is no better coach. In fact, right now, there is no better program. Yes, I said it. Right now, there is no better program. And not just with the two championships in the last 3 years. Look at what this team and this program and that coach have done over the last 5 years. And then the question, the obvious question, can you hold on to him if you're Villanova? Maybe. Jay Wright is the rare guy that when he says, this is my dream job, I believe this guy. Philly guy, his wife went there, he loves it there. Hey, maybe he's not going anywhere. If I were Villanova, I would give him whatever he wants just to make sure that somebody else doesn't do that. But maybe he is the rare guy that when he says, that is a dream job, this guy actually means it. Pat 40. Pat, good morning. Great to have you on. Pat, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, Jim. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm great. Nice to have you back, Pat. Thanks so much. Now, if I told you, Pat, before the game last night, that the most outstanding player of the Final Four would be a Villanova player who had a game for the ages, what are the odds that you would have said that that player would be Dante DiVincenzo?
There's no doubt he would have been down the list of potential suspects for that, for sure. You know, Jalen Brunson, Mikal Bridges, yes. Dante DiVincenzo, you know, I saw him actually in Pittsburgh light up Alabama in the first half in the second round of the NCAA tournament in a similar fashion. And I think, I want to say I'm not sure what he finished within that game, but I sure didn't come into Monday night saying that guy's going to go for the most points in a regulation championship game since Danny Manning. It was incredible.
You know, he was amazing last night, Pat, but he was not exactly a household name before last night, but he is a tournament legend right now, and not just for what he did on offense, but also what he did on defense. What was he like as a defensive player when he first arrived on campus, and what's that tell you about Jay Wright as a head coach?
You know, it's a great point, is that Jay said on the court afterwards, he said he played no defense when he got there. All he did, you know, he was a great athlete, he was a great scorer, and that's all he did. And he just basically took the other half of the game off playing defense. And that's the thing, you can't do that at Villanova and play. And I think he realized that, and you're competing against guys like Josh Hart and Jalen Brunson and some other guys from the 2016 championship team, and you realize pretty quickly how Villanova does it. And they get guys to buy in. And DiVincenzo did buy in. Yeah, he had a couple spectacular block shots. You know, he guarded the ball well. He's a well-rounded player. Probably still can get better defensively. And he even said, I am not the player, the complete player that Coach Wright wants me to be, but he's gotten a lot better, which is what Villanova players do.
Clones, you probably know this, but I live in Southern California. This is a huge, huge car town. We take our cars very seriously. We want to make sure that the whip is always looking its best, that our cars are always looking fresh. And like sports, car care is a game of numbers. And the best number for your car is 303 Automotive Premium Protectants and Cleaners. They're designed to clean, shine, and protect. 303 products undergo rigorous testing to ensure superior performance and outstanding protection, and to bring out that show car finish. From your dashboard to your tires, 303 keeps your car looking new, longer. 303, we've got your number. For more information, you want to visit my friends at 303radio.com. Trust me, I use it. I love it. 303radio.com. Once again, 303radio.com. We were talking to Pat Forty. You know, Pat Brunson got off to a great start last night, and then he struggled. But what's that say about this Villanova team, that the National Player of the Year has an off night, and they still win the national championship by nearly 20?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that, you know, that you can have a guy that's that important to your team play a very poor game. And I thought Brunson was a bit dead-legged. And you see on Monday night sometimes the end of this road really hits players, even good ones, and they really can struggle in that game. And I thought he was fatigued, but that's the thing. They've got other guys that can step up. You know, DiVincenzo was incredible. Bridges hit a bunch of shots in the second half. Eric Paschal had a little run here. You know, Amari Spellman makes some plays there. They just, you know, they are a complete program, and they are a dominant team. This is really, I think, one of the better NCAA champions we have seen in a while.
Pat Forty joining us. You know, Pat, when you talk about that point, was there a version of last night's game where Michigan actually wins, or as good as they were defensively, were they just in too deep against a Nova team that will eventually put points up on everybody?
Yeah, I think you would struggle to come up with a scenario where Michigan could have won. If it were a seven-game series, maybe they would take one. But, you know, I think they were – John Beilein did a very good job taking that team as far as it could go. It was a very good defensive team, but it was one of his poorer offensive teams. They didn't have as many shooters as usual, as many ball handlers. And so I just think Michigan was absolutely in over its head. They had a great start, went to Mo Wagner, and he really got him going well, but then reality struck. You know, Villanova made some adjustments, and the jig was up.
You know, Pat, as you pointed out before the game, North Carolina has never won two titles in 3 years. Neither is Kansas, neither is Indiana. Now that Villanova has, where does that place Jay Wright and the program?
Yeah, I think Jay Wright right now is the top coach in college basketball. You know, he doesn't quite have the lifetime resume of Mike Krzyzewski, but he's doing the best work by a wide margin of anybody in the game. They're four-year victory total is the highest in the history of the sport. 30-plus wins every year. They've been a one seed or a two seed five straight seasons, and now with two national titles in 3 years, they're it. They are the new blue blood, I think. You could look and compare like to Indiana, which hadn't been to a Final Four since 2002. Villanova's doing a heck of a lot more than Indiana is, and I think they belong in that top echelon now.
We're talking to Pat Forty. Now, Pat, you also wrote over the weekend that while Jay Wright is a legend right now, there was a time when he was at Hofstra, and he was 20 games below 500. What did his future in coaching look like at that point?
Yeah, it was iffy, you know, and I asked him about it. You know, you're 31-51, and did you think maybe this head coaching thing didn't cut out for you? And he's like, yeah, you know, he was talking to his wife about, you know, maybe go get an assistant coaching job in the NBA, maybe go into sales. And then I talked to Tom Pecora, who was an assistant with him at Hofstra, and he laughed. He said, heck, we were talking about opening a bait shop on the Jersey Shore. So The Jay Wright phenomenon, as we know it now, was pretty hard to see back in the mid-90s when he was there at Hofstra.
So, Pat, how did this guy go from a guy who was so far below 500 at Hofstra that he was joking about opening up a bait shop to winning two national championships in 3 years?
Yeah, you know, I just think it took him a few years just to kind of decide how he wanted to play, how he was going to coach players, how he was going to run a program, and then they hit it with a recruit, Speedy Claxton, at Hofstra, and it took off there. And then he took it to Villanova, and there was a little trial and error there as well. He was an NIT coach the first 3 years, and he was under pressure in year four. And then, boom, it happened. And, you know, I think he probably just had to get comfortable with both those places he was at and in those roles. And he's a smart guy. He figured out what kind of players he wanted, figured out how exactly he wanted to play, and then it all just pieced together incredibly well.
We're talking to national sports columnist for Yahoo, Pat Forte, college basketball in last night's championship game. You know, Pat, you look at Jay Wright, and the guy looks so amazingly cool on the sideline. The team looks like a machine on the court, to the point where it seems like maybe he's just pushing a few buttons, and then he sits back and takes it all in. If you're thinking that about that guy, how wrong are you about Jay Wright?
Yeah, I think he's certainly more than just a dapper sideline, you know, peacock or something like that. That's not who he is. He coaches a really tough team. They play tough. They practice really hard against each other. They can play gritty and ugly if they need to. I mean, this team made the most three-pointers in a season anybody's ever made, but if they get into a street fight, they can win that as well. And I think that's a reflection of who he is. He is so composed and calm and comes across as being all things to all people to a degree, but that doesn't mean there isn't an intensely competitive side to him and certainly to his team.
So, Pat, Jay Wright has got a team where he's won 30 games or more 4 straight years. Coach K has never done that. Roy Williams has never done that. He'll likely lose Jalen Brunson and Mikal Bridges to the NBA, but what does his team look like next season?
Oh, they'll be good again. I'd say I think Bridges and Brunson will be gone. And those are big hits, but, you know, they've got players, and they've got a very good recruiting class coming in. The interesting thing, Jim, to me, will be to see if Dante DiVincenzo's breakout night causes him to consider, maybe I want to go pro. Amari Spellman's another guy who some people think has pro potential. Will he put his name in? I think both those guys probably would be better served by another year of college, but, you know, see what the draft feedback comes back for them. And if they come back and the recruiting class coming in, Villanova is absolutely going to start the season in every top five, maybe top one or two.
So, Pat, before I let you go, why don't we take a view from, or look at the view from 30,000 feet. When you look back on the season and all the controversy, which you've been a big part of reporting on, where does the sport overall go from here?
Well, I think it's going to be a very uncertain offseason, a lot of apprehension, a lot of questions about what college basketball needs to do. And we'll start getting some answers in late April when the Condoleezza Rice Commission that was put together by Mark Emmert comes back with its recommendations. And I think there will be some recommendations for significant change there. And then I think there's going to be a willingness to accept the recommendations and actually turn them into something, unlike most NCAA committees that have ever been formed. So, you know, that'll be a start, but then everybody's also going to have one eye open when they put their head on the pillow at night to see, wondering where the FBI investigation is going and all this. Who else could be ensnared? What, as this thing moves forward and more becomes known about what has been found out during the probe, you know, how bad is this going to be? And I still think there's a very good chance it gets a lot worse for a lot of people.
And then, Pat, what about the coaches? I mean, it used to be that if you were a coach who got involved in a scandal, you were going to have a really hard time getting another job. How much of that is still the case right now?
Well, I still think that there's a business-as-usual mentality out there, which surprises me. Maybe it shouldn't. But, you know, when Mark Gottfried gets the Cal State Northridge job, when a grand jury subpoena has been handed down at North Carolina State for information, and there's documents that that we viewed that show that Dennis Smith, who had played at North Carolina State, received over $70,000 allegedly. I wonder who's actually paying attention and who cares about what the climate is, because there does seem to be kind of we're just going to keep going until somebody forces us to change our mindset.
So, Pat, where does that leave Rick Pitino? Pitino says he wants to coach again. Is he going to get the opportunity?
You know, I still think Rick's a Rick would be a very, very difficult hire to sell at this point. No doubt a brilliant coach, but it may take another couple of years at the earliest for him to be considered, touchable, especially at a program with any prominence.
Dudes, it's Tuesday, so what better time than right now to have some real talk? Here's your real talk. 66% of men lose their hair by age 35. And the thing is, when you start to notice hair loss, it's already too late. It's easier to keep the hair that you have than to replace the hair that you've lost. Look, you've got a problem, right? And now I've got a solution for you. That solution is for Hims.com, a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, sexual wellness for men. Thanks to science, baldness can be optional. Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. No waiting room, no awkward doctor visits. Save hours right now by going to forhims.com. It is so easy. How easy? This easy. You answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review and prescribe you. The products are then shipped directly to your door. Order right now. My listeners get a trial month of Hims for only $5 today while supplies last. See website for full details. It would cost hundreds if you went to a doctor or a pharmacy. Go to forhims.com/Rome. That's forhims.com/Rome. Forhims.com/Rome. Do it today. I want to take a few moments to talk about Jay Wright. Let me tell you something about Jay Wright. Let me tell you something that's more terrifying maybe than even an FBI investigation for college basketball. Gerald Taylor Wright Jr. And nobody deserves the full government treatment more than the man running that Nova dynasty. Because the best dressed guy in college basketball is going home to Philly with some new hardware. And a guy who used to get tagged with the rap that he can't win the big one and that he runs some gimmicky little offense just put a freaking buzzsaw right through the bracket. That is two for him. And again, unlike that icy dagger that Chris Jenkins dropped in 2016, my man could have kicked up his wingtips and enjoyed a victory stogie and a bottle of red for most of the second half. Now, you know, I'm never going to be that guy who builds Mount Rushmores or creates pantheons or power rankings of coaches. Never have, never will. But here is what I will say. Jay Wright is a master craftsman. Jay Wright is as good as there is when it comes to coaching basketball right now. On the college level for certain and pretty much anywhere. And Jay Wright looks like he's only going to get better. This guy's going to get better at what he does. And right now, nobody's doing it better than he is. What he's been able to do in the one-and-done era is insane. Because here's how Jay Wright dominates the one-and-done era. By having zero one-and-dones. By running out a starting lineup with four red shirts. And then bringing another one off the bench in tournament superstar Dante DiVincenzo. You know how you stay out of the muck that comes in the era of recruiting with AAU coaches and runners and bag men and NBA agents? By staying the hell out of the muck and not recruiting that kind of player. Now, don't get it twisted. You don't win 165 games over the past 5 years and cut down a couple of nets if you're not recruiting good players. And Wright can land those guys when he needs to. There's no doubt he can recruit and he can sell. Omari Spellman was a McDonald's All-American. So was National Player of the Year, Jalen Brunson. Both these guys picked Nova, and both these guys have balled out. But they are the perks of the system that Jay Wright has created, the culture. And they're not the fuel that keeps it alive. I mean, you know Jay Wright could own a living room if he wants to. You know he can win more than his share of battles with Cal and Coach K and Bill Self and Roy Williams. Hell, he's done things that those guys haven't done. Some of those guys. But he's not looking to get that type of player necessarily. And that's what makes this thing so scary. It's a slow boil. This is a foundation that's built, that's laid, brick by brick. It's a program that is gassed up. Gassed up, snacks in the car, a playlist loaded up, a thermos full of Java, absolutely ready for the long haul. Josh Hart leaves. Jalen Brunson takes his place. Brunson jets for the NBA. Plug in Dante next. And there's another wave that's already signed on the dotted line that's coming in, ready to keep that machine churning. I know the NBA is out there. I know there's an NBA paycheck for this guy out there. I know there's any GM in the association that could pick up the phone and offered to quadruple the paycheck of the 24th highest paid coach in college basketball. But here's what else I know. Philadelphia is Jay Wright's hometown. Nova is his wife's alma mater. And again, he might be the one guy who, when he says he has his dream job, he actually means it. He's telling the truth. And the guy's just 56. Still looks like a movie star. He could be running this monster for a long, long time. So, if I'm Villanova, I make sure I understand exactly what I have in this guy and that I give him literally whatever he wants. Because if you don't, somebody else might. And right now, not only is there not a better team in the country, there is not a better program, not a better leader than Jay Wright. And before you tell me to slow my roll, know this. Jay Wright has more national titles than Jim Boeheim. He's got more than John Calipari, more than Bill Self, more than Tom Izzo. No one, and I mean no one right now, is doing it better than Wright. Again, the second coach in Division I history to lead his team to four straight 30-win seasons. This dude is a stone-cold killer. And not only one of the best in the game, but when you consider what this guy's done there, pretty safe to say that right about now, one of the best to have ever done it. That good. And he's going to get better. And he's showing no signs of slowing down. I know I've hit this thing hard, but I want to make sure everybody understands exactly where I come out on this guy and that program and what they're doing and what they've accomplished. Not just this year, not just in the last 3 years, but in the last 5 years. It's historic. They're that good. And Philly, nobody will ever look at you the same way ever again. Nobody can ever say jack about you ever again. City of brotherly love, the city of champions. Benjamin Watson is my guest. Benjamin, good to have you back. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. You make me feel like a boxer coming out of the corner or something, man.
My man, you got a great resume. You really do. It's great to have you back on. Let me first ask you, you signed with the Saints last week, which means you're going to return for a second stint with that team. So how does it feel to be back with the Saints once again?
It feels great. It feels great. You know, going into year 15 and not quite knowing where you're going to be, it's always great to go back to a place where you have some familiarity. You know, used to being in that offense, familiar with the city, know the people in the building, kind of a reunion of sorts, but it's a blessing to be able to play again and also to be able to join a team that has been doing so well as of late.
Benjamin Watson joining us. So we'll get into that in a minute, but also you're reunited with a quarterback in Drew Brees. Now, you've played with a lot of really good quarterbacks in your career. What is it that makes Brees so special and so different?
Well, I can remember going to New Orleans and hearing about the legend of Drew Brees and then experiencing really the way he prepares. You know, he's a guy who I remember after practice coming in to work out and in the gym you can see into the indoor facility and seeing Drew out there going through his progressions by himself, nobody on the field, going through his progressions, calling plays to himself, visualizing where he was going to go with each football that he had a chance to throw in the coming game. And really seeing what it meant to prepare to succeed. And I think that's what separates him from a lot of guys. You know, a lot of guys have incredible talent. A lot of guys prepare very well. I'm sure there are many that prepare maybe in the same way. But he leaves no stone unturned. He works really hard. He also has a great rapport, I think, with the guys because there's that trust factor there. He wants to get things right and will always stay late to get it done.
We're talking to Benjamin Watson. You know, you also mentioned that one of the reasons you come back, aside from the familiarity, is this is a really good team. It's a team that's loaded on both sides of the ball. They had a strong season last year. So how good can this team be this year?
Well, you know, every year is different. One thing I've learned in this league throughout my career is that, you know, one year doesn't mean you're going to have success. And just because you have a poor season before doesn't limit you from what you can attain the next year. It is important, however, to build on your momentum. And so I know Coach Payton and the coaches there will understand that. I know that, you know, going into OTAs, training camp, mini camp, those sorts of things, they will remind us that just because you had success the year before doesn't mean you will have it. The great thing about this team is I think they did really well in the draft the last couple of years. They've got a lot of great young players who have contributed. It's always important to be able to build your team through the draft, to have guys that are going to be there for years. And whenever you can get a few draft picks that are rookies or first, second-year players that contribute the way these guys did, I think that bodes well for the future.
And then, of course, you got the leaders and the vets. So you've been a leader every single place you've been. So how do you approach it when you come to a team that's coming off the season that it had? I mean, do you go in there and try to feel your way out a little bit, or do you try to lead from the moment you step on that practice field?
Well, I think, you know, anytime you've been, you're considered kind of the old man. There's some sort of leadership that comes with that. But you also understand that, hey, this team has been successful in the past, especially last year. There are leaders on this team that when I was there a few years ago were younger players. Now they've taken that role. You know, I think of a guy like Cam Jordan or Mark Ingram. The list goes on. Teron Armstead. Guys who are leaders on that team now. And so it's not incumbent upon me as a guy coming in to try to assume that role. You know, I, honestly, my job right now is to see, to learn what to do, to learn maybe the differences in the offense from the last time I was there, to find my role throughout the course of the offseason program, to earn my role on this team because it is a new team. And then those that leadership, the role of leadership, however that looks this time, It will be there, but it may look different than it has in the past.
Benjamin Watson joining us, talking about his return to the Saints. You know, you play that game long enough, you're going to get hurt. You play it long enough, you're going to probably be seriously hurt. You tore your Achilles, and you missed your first season in Baltimore. Then you come back, and you lead the team in receptions last season. How much pride do you take in the fact that you were able to come back and then contribute the way you did?
It was really amazing to be able to step back on the field. After tearing my Achilles, you know, that injury is tough. I've had a number of injuries, and I will say the Achilles was probably the toughest. Well, it was the toughest rehab that I've had. I remember times sitting at the house, and my wife was taking care of all of us. We have five children plus me, which equals six, because I couldn't do anything. And so it was really just tough, I would say, for all of us, and really a great victory when I was able to come back onto the field. That being said, making it through all 16 games, contributing the way that I did, you know, and being able to try to help the team win, earning the trust back with the quarterback, with the offense, I really felt blessed to have that opportunity.
There's got to be some days when you're trying to rehab from something like that, and it's such a brutal rehab physically and mentally. There's going to be down days, right? There's going to be days where maybe even you think, you know, I don't know if I'm going to push through this. I don't know if I'll ever be the guy that I once was. But you talked about how powerful the motivation was for you, and the fact that you want to make an example for your kids and set an example for them. What was the example then that you were looking to set, and what did you want your kids to learn from you going through that process?
I mean, my kids literally pray for my Achilles every single day. Like, we pray at night before we go to bed, and we sit around it, and the kids would be like, Lord, I pray for Daddy's Achilles. Hmm. Even a year after, once I was back on the field, they still were because, you know, honestly, it takes years before you get back to yourself. You know, I kind of have a new normal. Of what I'm able to do, and it still isn't like it was before, but obviously it's functional enough to play, and there's still different challenges there. But I wanted them to see me go through some sort of adversity and fight back. I didn't know if that meant coming back onto the field and playing, or maybe it was, hey, guys, I tried as hard as I could. I fought as hard as I could, but it's just not going to work out as far as football goes. But you saw Daddy fight, because there are going to be times in your life where you are knocked down. There's going to be times when you fail. There are going to be times when you have injuries if you're in sports, or maybe in whatever you're in, there's going to be some sort of disappointment. But my hope is that you see, you learn perseverance, that you learn sacrifice, that you learn faith, all those sorts of things. And so when I was able to come back on the field, it really was a great celebration, not just for me, but for my entire family.
We're talking to Benjamin Watson. You know, that kind of response, really, this whole conversation leads me to the next thing. You were voted the Ravens Ed Block Courage Award winner last season, and the voting's done by your teammates. What's it mean to you? And we're talking about a locker room of guys that I know you respect, a brotherhood, alphas. I mean, the biggest alphas of alphas. What's it mean to you to know that you've got that kind of respect from people like that?
No, it's really humbling. You know, you know, we go through every single day as a team. You know, you fight through different things. You kind of gel together over the course of a season, over the course of the off season. And it's one thing when you know there's a certain level of respect there, but for guys to vote you in and for guys to give you that honor is really humbling. And being in Baltimore is special as well for the Ed Block Courage Award, because Ed Block was a trainer there in for the Baltimore Colts, and so. Going through that weekend and all the great charity events that are surrounding the Ed Block Foundation, being the representative from the Ravens was extra special.
Now, I would argue that as great a career as you've had, I would argue that you've done as well off the field as you have on. As an example, you were a finalist for the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award. And as I mentioned at the top, I mean, you're a Super Bowl champion. So when your career is over, what do you think is going to mean more to you, your accomplishments on the field or the respect that you've generated for your work off of the field?
You know, it's ironic because as an athlete, as a tight end, I want to be known for I always wanted to be known for catching touchdowns and playing great offense. And things that I'm known for is making a tackle on Champ Bailey years ago, which was a defensive play right. and stuff off the field. And it's kind of ironic that guys like, you know, it's not about you. And that's something that I've learned over the course of my career is that, you know, it's not about me. It's not always what I want, the accolades that I want. But people can be reached through the avenue of sport and what I've done in sport, but also outside of that. And I consider it really a great privilege to be known for many of those other things because those things are really what's going to last. The opportunity to share about my faith, the opportunity to help people that are in dire situations, the opportunities to fight for justice for those who are lacking, the opportunity to help people who are in need. Those are all things that I really hold dear, and those are things that, again, talking about my children and talking even about the legacy that I'm able to leave in the locker room, those are things that I want guys to really grasp. You know, the football stuff is important, and don't get me wrong, you know, I'm still striving to one day, you know, be the best football player that I can possibly be. But being known for those things off the field really goes, in my opinion, a lot further, and that's the legacy, and that's the change that I want to have in every community that I go to.
Yeah, so when you're impacting so many people doing those things, and you've got so many things that are so important to you off of the field, so many things that you could be doing, what is it that keeps you playing football?
Yeah, well, the opportunity, honestly, the door that opens. After this past season, we were prepared for it to be my last. 2 years ago, I was prepared for it to be my last. After this year, we'll kind of reevaluate and do the same thing. I've always said that if the door, you know, shuts, then I'm fine with that, and it's time to move on. But the door seems to be open right now. And football is a great avenue. It's a great platform. It's a great job, you know, to provide for my family. It's all those things, and it gives me the opportunity to do any of the other things that I think will take me and my family into the future as far as being change agents in my community. But when I entered into the league in 2004, I never imagined that I would play this long. Honestly, after like 5 years and being hurt so much, I was ready to quit.
Sure.
But God has allowed me to come back, and you know, I consider it a blessing to be able to keep playing.
Benjamin Watson joins us for a few more moments. I want to ask you about a powerful post on Instagram over the weekend. It was a photo of you and your grandfather who passed away on April 1st, 2004, only 24 days before you were selected in the NFL draft. How painful was it to lose him then? And then what kind of an impact did he have on you?
It was hard. He's my father's dad. And so we lived right around the corner in Norfolk, Virginia, on the other side of the block from my grandparents. And so we would, you know, as kids, we would go walk around the block to grandma and granddaddy's house and hang out in the garage. And, you know, he'd give us sodas and lollipops and stuff, and we'd hang out while he would work on his Cadillac and stuff like that. And so I have many fond memories of my grandfather. He used to give us haircuts and all those sorts of things. And so he really loved football. He loved the Cowboys, ironically, even though we lived in Virginia. But as I went through college and as I was getting close to the NFL, he started getting sick. He had colon cancer. Eventually, as I said in the post on April 1st, April Fool's Day, he passed away 24 days before. And so, you know, many people go through grief. Many people lose people that they love. And so for me, it was really tough, especially being drafted and him knowing that he would want to be there and see it. So it was emotional when I got drafted. But really, I think that just his legacy of being a strong man, a father, a husband, of the way he led my father, and now me two generations later, I can really see the ramifications of the sacrifices that he made.
Meantime, the NFL draft does get underway 3 weeks from Thursday. I, for one, cannot wait for this. In fact, I'm more eager, I think, for the draft than the draft prospects. And they're the ones who are being poked and prodded. They're the ones who want to know where they're going to live and where they're going to work and how much they're going to get paid. And I still don't think these guys want it as badly as I do. And the reason for that, I already know where I live. I know where I'm going to work. I know where I'm paid or what I'm paid. And I still can't wait for this thing to happen because for me, it's going to represent the end of all the pre-draft buildup. The pre-draft buildup that is always weird. And in this case, weird is not good. Weird is scouts and analysts throwing out bizarre and made-up terms like suddenness, waistbender, or worse. You know, for the first month after the Super Bowl, it's fine. it's a little reminder that football still exists. There's not a hell of a lot else going on. So you're cool with it. But then as time drags on and every prospect has already been analyzed, there are still a few weeks left to kill. And that's when everything gets weird. And we're not officially, or we've now officially reached DEFCON 2 when it comes to weirdness. And that's with the recent coverage of Josh Rosen. First, there was everybody freaking out about what his former coach, Jim Mora, had to say regarding Sam Darnold and how he'd be a better fit in Cleveland. And now everybody's freaking out because Jim Mora said that Rosen is smart. He told MMQB that Rosen, quote, needs to be challenged intellectually so he doesn't get bored. He's a millennial. He wants to know why. Millennials, once they know why, they're good. Josh has a lot of interest in life. If you can hold his concentration level and focus only on football for a few years, he will set the world on fire. He has so much ability, and he's a really good kid, end quote. And then Rosen appeared to respond with a pair of tweets. The first of which was, why? Followed by the shrug emoji. And then, hashtag, why? And then the second was, quote, opinions. Hashtag, things people take too seriously. You know, and I gotta say, the guy couldn't be more correct. The guy could not be more correct. I mean, why? 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 Guys, right. Why? Why? And people are taking this whole thing way too seriously. First off, I know that at this time of year, college coaches are typically jumping up and down on the table for their guys. So anything that's not that is going to be seen as a criticism. But are we really at the point in the draft evaluation process where saying that a guy is smart is a criticism? And are NFL coaches so weird about having a smart quarterback, a quarterback who wants to know the thought process behind every play call and every detail? Are we at a point where those coaches find that threatening? And the answer to both of those things apparently is yes. Now, could Jim Mora have worded his comments a little bit differently? Sure. But if you read a coach saying that his player is really smart and needs to be challenged intellectually, and that if he does, he will, quote, set the world on fire, and you read that as a reason to not draft him, then I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I know there are NFL people who will see this and think, yeah, that is a little bit concerning. Yeah, maybe we steer clear of this guy. But, I mean, how wrong would that be? Put another way, if you would rather have a dumb quarterback who's not interested in knowing why you do things or how you do things, you go right ahead. You draft somebody dumb. All things being equal, I think I'm going to take the smart guy. And if you don't want to draft Rosen, that's fine. There may be some very good reasons for not wanting to draft him. But the fact that he's smart is not one of them. Tom Brady wants to know the thought process behind every single play. And how's that worked out for the Patriots? That's not to say that Josh Rosen is the next Tom Brady. Nobody is. But to argue that being smart should be viewed as a bad thing, to me, is one of the dumbest things. And one more thing about this. It's kind of weird. That whole notion of the term millennial, the inclusion of the word millennial. If an NFL team is threatened by that, then they're going to be in for a very long draft because it's not like Rosen is the only millennial in that draft. In fact, I'm pretty sure most guys are pretty much the same age. That's kind of how the draft works. They get out and they're about the same age. It's not like you can draft a Gen Xer in 2018. And you probably wouldn't want to draft a baby boomer in this year's draft. I mean, sure, if you want somebody from the greatest generation on your roster, you'd be my guest. Just don't expect that guy to blaze a fast 40. What I'm saying is, to me, the draft cannot get here fast enough. That clock cannot spin quickly enough, and those calendar pages cannot fly off fast enough for me. Roll on, Arlington. Let's get there already. Because the hot takers are out in full force. Full force. Howard Beck joins us. Howard, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Good, Romy. What is up?
Howard, always good to talk to you, but especially today, couldn't wait to get your thoughts on Jason Kidd. Let me start right there. I bring this up because Jason Kidd was named as a member of the Hall of Fame class of 2018, and you spent some time recently with him, Howard, which is significant because that was the first extended interview that he has done since he was fired in Milwaukee. So first off, how did the conversation come to be, and how well did you know him before you sat down with him?
You know, it's funny, Jim, because I never covered Jason on a day-to-day basis in my beat writing days. I covered a couple months of his 1 year with the Knicks. Didn't know each other that well, but we've had our conversations intersected here and there over the years. I, like a lot of people, I'm sure, had put out feelers through channels back when he got fired, saying, listen, I'm sure he's laying low for a bit, but even when he's ready to talk, would love to chat with him. He could come on the podcast. We could sit down, whatever it may be. And then, you know, it was kind of, no, he's laying low. And then a few weeks back, heard back that, listen, he is ready to chat, and though you guys don't know each other well, maybe this is actually the best way for him to kind of reemerge, put his voice back out there. I think because of the fact that, you know, I think it was clear to Jason and some folks around him that I wasn't going to go easy on him, for one, and I was, you know, not, you know, we didn't have an established relationship one way or the other, neither pro nor con, and so I think that probably helped. So we spent some time together. I went out to Phoenix. He's living outside of Phoenix. We had breakfast and just, you know, BS for a while. Just got to know each other for a bit. We both got Bay Area roots. We just talked about growing up in the Bay Area. Talked a little bit about, you know, just basketball stuff. And it was really comfortable. It was the most I'd ever really chatted with Jason, just informally. Then we went back to his home. Sat in the backyard for a while on a very nice 80-degree day or so in Phoenix while it was freezing back here in New York.
Right.
And then we had the interview, and I presented to him. I said, listen, I've been making calls. These are the things I've heard from folks in Milwaukee. These are the things I've heard from folks in Brooklyn. This is where people think you might have gone wrong or off track or didn't quite know how to handle situations. And to his credit, I thought he addressed all that very well. Not defensive, but did defend himself. And people took that, you know, through whatever lens they wanted to.
Howard Beck joining us. All right, so Jason Kidd is one of the few people, Howard, to make that transition from playing to coaching immediately. And he was one of the all-time great players. That means he's never been involved in basketball or never not been involved in basketball for essentially his entire life. Now that he's had a little bit of time to reflect, where do you think he is in terms of his time as a head coach?
I think he feels more comfortable with his abilities as a head coach now. I mean, I think, well, he didn't say it outright. You know, I asked him probably three different ways. Were you ready for this? Was it too soon? Because personally, I don't think a guy is ready. As smart as Jason Kidd is about the game, as steeped in the game as he is, as great of a playing career as he had, the idea of taking off your jersey, putting on a coat and tie and saying, I'm the head coach now, just weeks later, days later, I'm not sure is the best path. It didn't work out that well for him, although he rallied in Brooklyn that year. And it didn't work out that well for Derek Fisher, who did something similar, going straight from playing for the Thunder to coaching the Knicks. And now, that said, of course, nobody can succeed coaching the Knicks. but, you know, I think Jason realizes that there were some things he didn't know about how to put together a staff, about just the day-to-day organizing of the team, structure of practices, all those things. It takes some time to get up to speed on. I think he's in a better place now. And I think, you know, look, the record is mixed, to say the least, in Milwaukee. But I also think that team, to a point that Jason Kidd has made, that team is young. And it is still trying to find its identity. And I don't know that, you know, that anybody coaching that team right now would have anything more than an up-and-down ride. Because that's who they are. That's who the roster is. So, you know, if Jason Kidd is hired again, and I don't know if there's any guarantee that that's going to happen, but if Jason Kidd gets another crack in this next round of coach hirings, I think he'll be a much better equipped and more mature version of himself than he was when he jumped right into it in Brooklyn a few years back.
We're talking to Howard Beck. So one final thought on that. When you made your phone calls and you heard what people had to say about him, I'm sure one of the raps that came back was he just pushed guys too hard. Like, he would point to his own career and to the careers of guys like Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, who work like crazy. Was he expecting players to put in the same level of work that he put in? And is that too high of an expectation?
Yes and yes. And though he was reflective about that, he didn't exactly concede the point. Like, I think he feels like he's still right to do that. And so if you're going to hire him, I think that's what you're buying into. You're going to have to either get assurance from him in the interview that he's ready to moderate his own impulses a little bit, or maybe you want that. Maybe you think that that's what your team needs, and maybe you also have to go into realizing that a coach who takes that tack, who is relentless, who is that taxing and demanding, they sometimes have a shelf life. And, you know, that's why we saw Scott Skiles burn teams out back in the day. We've heard rumblings about that with Tibbs, not only in Chicago, but even with the current team in Minnesota. You hear that from folks around the league sometimes, that that style of coaching might have a limited impact in today's NBA and with today's NBA players. And so, you know, is Jason Kidd going to moderate that a little bit? Or is that just going to be his style? And are you, and do you have the kind of team that can take that? And maybe you need a more veteran team for that. Maybe the young guys just don't respond to that, or at least don't respond to it year after year. So we'll see. But, you know, there's that aspect of it, Jim, and there's also this, that Jason, while I found him to be much more personable and engaging when we sat down a couple weeks ago, in general, his persona on the sidelines, in practices, with players and with the media, he's kind of always had this like distance, this bit of distance that he puts between himself and you, whoever you may be. I don't know that he has learned to get to balance that out. You know, we talk about how Pop has got this ability to be so demanding of his players and tear into him at times, but then put that arm around him, give him a hug, give him some encouragement. You have to be able to do both, and I don't know if Jason Kidd has found that right balance yet to give his guys, you know, some tough love along with just the tough driving directives.
You know, it really is a fascinating point that you make, Howard, because I've known him a long, long time. And I, even as a media guy, I've always had a very good relationship with him, but he can be guarded, he can be intimidating, and he may not be that guy to ever put your arm around you. But I knew him. I've told the story a million times, Howard, but he came on my show the night after Everett came over the table when he was coming out of Cal. And I'll never forget Jason Kidd. Number one, he could have come off the show. He could have canceled, and he did not. And I'll never forget that he did the interview and then walked off the set and looked back at me and said, "Hey, Rome, good luck with those phone calls," and gave me a little bit of a wink. And he and I have always had a really good relationship. So I think that maybe even if he's not there yet in terms of putting that arm around that guy and saying, "Hey, I get it. I understand you and it." That's not to say that he won't get there. You'd probably agree with that. Now, a guy who does understand that, of course, is Steve Kerr. You had him on your podcast a few weeks back. This has not been the easiest season for Golden State, but then again, Kerr would not expect sympathy from anybody at all. What's your sense of what he's made of the season they've had thus far?
It's interesting. I think, you know, when you get to this point in that run with the Warriors, whether you're Steve Kerr, whether you're Bob Myers, whether you're one of those core players, I think there's a certain zen that just comes with it. Like, we've been to three straight finals. We've won two championships. Sure, we've had kind of a weird up and down season. Yeah, we've had some injuries. Yeah, we don't know what Steph is going to look like in, you know, in the playoffs or when he's back. But I get the sense, and, you know, it was a few weeks ago that I was out there, and so they've been through some more since then. I get the sense that the Warriors, they can afford to have a more relaxed is maybe the wrong word, but like just this zen mentality. They know who they are. They know what they're capable of. They know they've still got probably the best trio of players, even without Steph. So, you know, they're ahead of the game in that regard. But I think they also know that the Rockets may present the stiffest challenge they've had since this run began. And, you know, I think we're all looking forward to that eventual showdown, assuming it happens. But I don't get the sense that the Warriors are sweating anything that's happened so far. They know that the real season begins a week from Saturday, a week from Sunday probably for them. And then we'll see. But we are going into this postseason with the Warriors with that huge question mark. When is Steph coming back? What's he going to look like? Can he get back to 100%?
All right, so where does that leave us? And a final thought from you. If you had to say right now, how do you see the Western Conference playoffs going? Are the Rockets now the team to beat, or is Golden State the title favorite until somebody does beat them?
No, I think the Warriors are still the team to beat. And it's not just the proverbial, hey, you know, you got to favor them until someone beats them, and you give them that because they're the defending champion. There's part of that. But it's also just the fact that there are only a few, like, true, like, just, you know, mutant superstars in this game, and Durant is one of those guys. And, you know, even without Steph, you've got an MVP-caliber player there in Durant who is pretty much unguardable. And I know the Rockets, they can switch everything, and they got all these, you know, 6'7", 6'8", guys that they can put on him. I still think that a Warriors team that has been there, that has is proven, that has established chemistry and still has three All-Stars, is still the odds-on favorite. And by the way, you know, we haven't completely lost track of the fact that, that Chris Paul, James Harden do not have great postseason resumes of their own. And until we see otherwise from them, it's fair to wonder whether they're going to be different this time.
No, we have not lost track of that fact at all. All right, so one last thought then. In the East, how different, Howard, are the 76ers without Joel Embiid? And if he comes back quickly, could they make any noise in their first year in the postseason?
Yeah, a lot of people didn't like this, but a week ago, and it was unfortunately just the day before Embiid went down, I did one of our spotlight videos in which I said, listen, there's a path to the Eastern Conference Finals for the Sixers, which I would rarely say about a young team that's never even been in the playoffs before. But there's a path because the East is really unsettled, because the Sixers still have a shot to get home court in the first round, and because all of these teams have blemishes. There are just no sure things in the East right now. And yeah, if you draw the Cavs in the second round, you know, I'm going to probably put my money on LeBron over anybody. But the Sixers, with Embiid, can make a run, a good run. Without Embiid, you know, Ben Simmons is still phenomenal, and he's going to do some great things for that team, but you just don't have that 1-2 punch that you need to make a deep run. But they have the talent and the shooting, and I think just those intangibles that make them a potential really fun team in the playoffs that could put together a run. But they got to get Embiid back, and we don't know exactly when that's going to be.
Mark in Hollywood. Mark, what's going on? Good morning.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised, but you'll never catch me wearing blue and maize. Chilling last night, relaxing, I was cool, watching Men of Michigan wet the bed like little tools, but a little prick in Boston was up to no good, overcompensating in the jungle neighborhood. But after another mission lost, Mark in Boston got scared and said, I'm removing this tattoo because it's not fair. Oh, Jim, you know, it's funny. When I heard that Harbag's personal khaki stain cleaner took a run at me on the show yesterday, I got to admit, I was tempted to call back in and crack back on him and that archery school. But then I thought I'd let their Bohegian karma play out. And lo and behold, here it comes again. But Mark, I don't get it. You seem to be one of the smarter idiots to come out of that pee and urinal cake colored cesspool. How could you even ponder last night going any differently for you jackasses? And you have the nerve to diss my Philly and Pennsylvania affiliations? Okay, that's fine. Let's run down the recent history, and you let me know if you and your useless degree in botany can keep up. First, during the season, Penn State obliterated your Division II football team 42-13, and then not only do you get proceeded to get blown out by Ohio State, but then you finish off that bleep show with being the only Big Ten team to not win a bowl game, you absolute clowns. And if that wasn't enough, the ultimate Michigan man himself, the adultering, plastic chin-wearing leader of that cult that bilks people out of money, inventor of the TB12 method, Tom Brady, was whacked by my Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl because Tommy and the hoodie were too busy making out with their kids. And on top of all of that, you still had a chance to salvage a shred of respect by falling far through the tourney to the championship game, only to get your front-running asses handed to you by who? A school from Philly. Look, Mark, I'm a solutions-oriented guy. I'm not here to help. I'm here to hurt. Unfollowing everyone on Twitter, which he has, Jim, doesn't make this go away. You need to do what that seizing spasmatic Chris Webber never did, take responsibility for wetting yourself, and it'll all go away. And next time you come at me, Philly or Penn State, I'm going to peacock my Eagles Super Bowl and Penn State NIT championship all the way over to your coke-riddled, racist, post-apocalyptic city of Boston and shove it down your throat with a chaser of Samuel Adams lager and clam chowder. It's 9:52, and Michigan still sucks. Ann Arbor's a hoe.
Damn. Mark in Hollywood. Mark, you do know today is not the smack-off, right?
Good night,